you know, it's an old characterization. So, but, you know, going forward, I guess we should be back on. It doesn't help so much. There's not so much time left. But for the next next week, we'll be on regular, hopefully regular schedule and regular Sunday. My own wandering days hopefully are you know, at least temporarily coming to an end. So, again, I appreciate everybody's flexibility. So we were discussing the problem of Yira, a little bit of Ava, too, as I recall, and especially how it relates to Talmud Torah and, again, the particularly the response to the Mussar movement. We spoke a little bit about, we'll speak more about some of the hallmarks of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's approach. And his Talmidim. We also noted that there are really different, you know, schools within the world of Mussar, and they too elicited different responses. Again, the Navardic school and, you know, the idea of Katna Sa'adam or Gadla Sa'adam, the opposite, which certainly is part of the, you know, part of the issue. There's one part of the issue is the question of the self-sufficiency, or in the other direction, inadequacy of Talmud Torah, or you know, as opposed to not only self-sufficiency, but, you know, Talmud Torah keneged kulam, really having, you know, a much broader meaning, or hafoch ba de kula ba, having a much broader meaning, meaning the idea that, you know, Talmud Torah isn't just limudat Torah, and it's not just all of the different components that includes, lilmod amanas salasos, and, you know, and limud lishma, but that it is, you know, the ultimate in Avodas Hashem, and also the pillar and the linchpin for other institutions as well, which it is. You know, the role of, we talked about extensively, Talmud Torah's connection to Yerushalayim, Talmud Torah's connection to Avodas Hashem. Again, the Rambam in Sefer HaMitzvos and Chazal, who speak about Ava as being something that flows from, you know, Limud Taraso, but not just that. Also, you know, the idea of Tshuva, which we've talked about in the past. You know, the Rambam thinks that Tshuva is very intimately connected, you know, to Limud HaTorah and to Limud HaTorah Lishma. The Rambam in Perek Yud of Hilchos Tshuva, which is the end of Hilchos Tshuva, you know, the idea of Tshuva Me'ava, you know, being something that is particularly connected to Tshuva B'derech Talmud Torah, Ki HaMitzvah Zos, which the Ramban in the end of Devarim says is the Mitzvah Zos refers to the Mitzvah of Tshuva. We've talked about this in, you know, pre-Yom Narayim talks. You know, the Rambam, really, the Gemara in Erevin, which Rashi quotes on the Psukim there, Ki HaMitzvah Zos Lo Vashamayim, Lo Me'ever Layam, and so on, the Gemara Erevin and the Rambam codifies it as well. And the Talmud Torah think that it refers to Limud HaTorah. So again, the Ramban knew this, obviously. He knew the Gemara Erevin just as well as, you know, Rashi and the Rambam did, and he also knew Rashi and the Rambam. So his decision, you know, to use that same, you know, pasuk, which is a big Pia Mitzvah Zos, is like an intentional ambiguity in the Torah for the institution of Tshuva, is not a coincidence. So the idea that, you know, Talmud Torah keneged kulam, and that hafoch ba de kula ba, whether in actual perush or in sensibility, refers to, you know, Torah's multiple linchpin, you know, status, is something which is very well documented, and really something that we believe in, you know, as a tenet of the faith. So in the world of Lita, of Lithuania, and everything that is connected to it, and not limited to that world, but definitely in the Gra and Reb Chaim Mivolozhin, and in Brisk and other offshoots of that world, you know, this idea, you know, is very critical. So even separate from those are really now really two issues, you know, in discussing, you know, relation to the Muslim movement. One is the perspective on the nature of man, and, you know, his default inclinations, his, you know, capacity, his abilities, and so on and so forth. That's where you get the whole Navardic discussion. And as far as that is concerned, we'll document this, but whether it's the Chazon Ish or the Rav in Ishalacha, but again, the Lithuanian you know, perspective was that, you know, man is this, you know, part of Tzelem Elokim means, you know, that man, you know, is destined for greatness and is capable of greatness. And that doesn't mean he doesn't have nisyonos, but mostly the adinut, which is a phrase that the Chazon Ish in particular uses a lot. When he talks about Talmidei Chachamim and Dalei Ha'am, it's an interesting use of terms. But somebody who has dignity and who has subtlety and who has, you know, adinut. Again, it's one of those words, you know, that is better than all of its translations. Is really, you know, the synonymous, or at least abstractly supposed to be synonymous, you know, with the Talmud Chacham. So, on one level, that whole debate is about you know, the nature of man and how he should be conducting himself. Even a this-worldly aspect, we've come to talk about Isha Halacha, which we'll talk about more in a moment, the this-worldliness of the Isha Halacha as a lechatchila, not just as a b'di'eved, you know, was at odds, really, with those initially powerful strands, you know, in the Muslim movement. But even quite separate from that, that's really what the point I'm trying to make, is that even if you take the most idealistic perspective on the Muslim movement, which is that, you know, you need, you know, to augment your limud haTorah and your performance of mitzvos, you know, by certain psychological mechanisms or a Yiras Shamayim, which is, you know, separate from, although certainly complementary to limud haTorah. Even that, as I say, really, in theory, could be offensive, you know, to somebody who took this more, again, my phrases, but hafochba or keneged kulam in this bigger way. And that was the passage that I read last time from the Isha Halacha, where the Rav said that Reb Chaim, you know, opposed the introduction of Musar in Velazhen, you know, arguing that, you know, all the Mekoros and Chazal that you know, talk about the inadequacy of Talmud Torah for, you know, people who, you know, really have pursued Talmud Torah, you know, imperfectly, and who therefore are in the category of a chola, you know, but just as you don't prescribe medicine for the healthy, because that throws off the homeostasis of the person, right, so too, you know, meddling, I guess, or interfering, or with the balance of Talmud Torah keneged kulam, you know, by injecting other things that are more extraneous, or clearly extraneous anyway, is something which is unacceptable as well. And the end of the passage that we read then, I think this was on page 74, you know, it was clear that either the Rav or Reb Chaim, you know, was, you know, already opening, you know, the door, you know, to a non-Navardic, you know, kind of Musar, but not, you know, because the castor oil, you know, mashal was wrong, but because, I guess, of a recognition that, you know, some people are imperfect, you know, in their, or inconsistent in their Torah study, as if only they were, you know, I guess, completely immersed, you know, and driven or tuned and driven and defined by it, then, you know, in Achanami, even, you know, a more optimistic, you know, and positive posture regarding man, you know, would be still something which detracts from Talmud Torah keneged kulam, and the implication of Torah's inadequacy, you know, would be problematic. However, in the end of the day, you know, since many people, you know, do have other agendas, or, you know, in Reb Chaim Vivalajan terms, you know, their Torah isn't always, you know, lishma, or purely lishma. Maybe there's some, you know, lishma v'shalo lishma, you know, to use some kadshim and also Korban Pesach terminology. But in the end of the day, so then there's room for some sort of, I guess, adjustment. But even then, it's not the adjustment, you know, of Navardik. It's the, you know, it's the kinder, gentler, more optimistic type. And that's what he says. You know, there's no need here for castor oil if the scholars of Kelm and Kovno feel compelled to drink bitter drugs. Let them drink to their heart's content, but let them not invite others, you know, to dine with them. And then later, He talks about the distinction between different different strands of the Musar movement, and that's kind of more b'di'eved awareness, that people aren't perfect, therefore, notwithstanding this principle, there can be room for certain trends here. But this, I say, in Brisk in particular, this is very extreme because the whole ideology of Ish Halacha, the idea that the Halacha is the foundation of everything and that, it's the foundation of values and philosophy and, it has, again, this notion of an inner logic, all make, this antagonism and certainly rejection of Musar in principle, something which is a very, at least in theory, something which is a very compelling argument. And this is, connected to some of the other passages here. It would seem to me, let me see if I can find it. So the again, the Rav's perspective here is reflected in other passages as well. And just read one or two quickly, and then I want to talk about other strands, including the Chazon Ish. The approach to God is also made possible by the Halacha. Primarily, Halachic man cognizes God via his Torah, via the truth of Halachic cognition. There is truth in the Halacha. There is Halachic epistemology. There is a Halachic thinking. According to the Pasuk in Eov, there is a Torah wisdom that is broader than the sea, and all of these are rooted in the will of the Holy One, blessed be He, it's better in Hebrew, the revealer of the law. This approach is not an ethical, practical approach like that of Kant and Hermann Cohen, but a theoretical, normative one. It is via the ideal world in which creation and the norm blend together that man approaches God. We require neither miracles nor wonder to prove the existence of God, for the Halacha itself bears witness to its creator. So you can just see in these passages, and this is ABC, really, of the Rav's legacy and his chidush in Machshava, which, again, is implicit in the world of Brisk, but the Rav is certainly the one who philosophically articulated it, and I think maybe the only one who, in a way, could have. But what he's saying is that, the halacha, hafoch ba, hafoch ba, tekula ba. It's the basis of our kesher with the Rabbonu Shalom. It's the basis of, a substitute for miracles, and any kind of struggle with the existence for God, right? To be sure, we can also find in the halacha a practical approach to God, an approach through the performance of commandments in a concrete fashion. But this approach only follows in the wake of the first approach. The primary approach to God is the ideal, normative, theoretical relationship that prevails between God and between halachic man. So this is a very powerful statement. Again, another example of this. This is, again, it's chalked throughout the whole book, but for the whole article. Halachic man, on the contrary, is very sparing in his recitation of piyutim, not heaven forbid on account of philosophical qualms, but because he serves his maker with pure halachic thought, precise cognition, and clear logic. This is trying to explain why Reb Chaim was not so into, piyut, and that he was critical of, too much, saying of Tehillim, that comes at the expense of Limud HaTorah. He does not waste his time, again, these are a little bit harsh, reciting songs and hymns. I don't know if Reb Chaim would have been for Karlbach Minyanim, I suspect not. The cognition of the Torah, this is the holiest and most exalted type of service. So you see, this spills it over into whole other institutions, as I mentioned before, but also into whole other areas of Avodas Hashem. And it isn't a certain extreme, but it's a very inspiring extreme. Not necessarily one that needs to be fully embraced, but the sensibility behind it, I think, does, and I'll explain that. He serves the Creator by uncovering the truth in Halacha, by solving difficulties, resolving problems. Once my father entered the synagogue on Rosh Hashanah, late in the afternoon after regular prayers were over, and found me reciting Psalms, Tehillim, with the congregation. He took away my psalm book and handed me a copy of Tractate Rosh Hashanah. Quote, if you wish to serve the Creator at this moment, better study the laws pertaining to the festival. While the congregation would recite piyutim in the day of awe, Reb Chaim would study Torah. On Rosh Hashanah, he would study the laws of Shofar, the Day of Atonement, laws pertaining to the sacrificial order of the day. The Rebbeinu Sholem himself sits and studies the Torah and only has in his world the four cubits, Arba Amos Shel Halacha. Study of Torah is not a means to another end, but is the end point of all desires. That's really the idea of Torah Lishma. That's Reb Chaim Nivalajan's, you know, Nefesh HaChaim. It's the most fundamental principle of all. The whole notion of Torah Lishma, again, you can just see the strands connecting for its own sake or for the sake of the divine name, primarily refers to studying for the sake of the love of Torah, that one should exert oneself to determine the root principle of the law. But a person may think that Lishma means for the sake of cleaving to God. This is just a restatement of Reb Chaim Vivalajan, meaning the idea that Limud HaTorah is L'shem Dveikus by Kadosh Baruch Hu, even though that is the result of what happens. But what should be the motivation? Again, that's barely, that's, you know, really very little to criticize there, frankly. If everybody's Limud HaTorah, you know, Lishma was L'shem Dveikus, you know, by Kadosh Baruch Hu, you know, I think we can all mostly live with that. But Reb Chaim Vivalajan and the Ravs, again, repeating this, in his, you know, also in his name, is suggesting that even that is, you know, a compromise or dilutes, let's say, the full independent significance of Torah and of Limud HaTorah. Therefore, according to this opinion, it would be preferable for one to occupy himself with songs, meaning one who says that it's Veikus Bashem, and hymns, and in particular with the Psalms of David, Tehillim, the sweet singer Noem's Ne'im Zimrot Yisrael, that arouse in one love of God and a sense of his closeness. And this is sufficient for him, and in this manner he will obtain a pleasant life. But such is not the case. For the Medrash on Tehillim states that David HaMelech requested that Hashem account one who would recite the Psalms as being on the same level as one who studies the laws of leprosy and tents, right? The Goyim and Olos. This clearly implies that the study of these laws is of more value than the recitation of Psalms. And there is no indication in the Medrash that God granted him his request. This is so because the primary purpose of study is not simply to study for the sake of cleaving to God, but to comprehend through the Torah the commandments and the laws, and to know each and every matter clearly, both its general principles and its particulars. Thus, one should study these matters, these laws, for the sake of matters themselves, so that one will comprehend these matters and deepen one's understanding and analytic skill, and not study simply for the sake of cleaving to God, as many have erroneously thought. Rather, one must delve profoundly and inquire into the very concrete materiality of these laws. For example, when one studies civil law, Choshe Mishpat, one must at times closely analyze the issue of Migu. Okay, we all know what a migu is. Now, migu raises the question of the psychology of liars. We ask ourselves if a particular party were a liar, what type of plea he might put forward. Thus, even though at the time of the study a person does not have the fear of God in mind, nevertheless, the study itself is for the sake of the unification of the Holy One, blessed He. As you're studying migu, you're studying Torah. Therefore, when a person exerts himself to understand a halakhic matter clearly, it is certain that the Shekhinah, the Divine Presence, rests upon him at the moment he is studying. As the sages have stated, God only has in his world four cubits of halacha. The above is the declaration of Reb Chaim Vivalajan, the outstanding student of the Gaon of Vilna, the founder of the Yeshiva of Vilajan, and it would appear to me that it needs no comment. Okay. The fact that it needs no comment needs no comment. That is really where, you know, the Rav was coming from ideologically. That's where Brisk comes from. Brisk is a, one could say, in my opinion now, in other words, it's you know, it's an application, almost a natural yet stupendous, you know, application of this ideology translated into methodology. You know, logic, articulation, separate vocabulary. Again, the focus on inner logic areas like Kachim Tara Zraim. You know, the terminology not only being independent but being abstract, chaloses and so on and so forth. All of this is really, you know, the next step or the consistent application on the level of actually sitting down. What is the nature of the Shaklatari, the Gemara? What are we, you know, interested in? And so forth. Again, I don't think it's so necessarily well understood. But this is exactly what it is. Now, taking a step back before I move away from the Rav a little bit, is I think a lot of this, you have to understand also that the Rav's writings are intended to be extreme. He wrote, in a typological way, you know, it has, you know, the advantage, you know, being number one, very dramatic and very clear and impactful. Moreover, again, I think that too, because of the Rav, again, one of his great legacies is, you know, taking, you know, lumdus, call it, and, you know, creating a machshava, you know, extension or analog to it. And I've said this in the past, unlike Rav Elbel, who, you know, in the tradition of the Mishnah Melech and others, would halachasize, you know, Medrash and Chazal, often, not always. The Rav wasn't, you know, that wasn't his approach. His approach was really to take the halacha and to translate it also into values, you know, and to into categories. Typology, that's using extreme, like, paradigms and models that, you know, are intentionally extreme, is part, really, of that, not only the clarity and the drama, you know, but also of this notion. Like, everything is a sugya, you know. And everything, you know, the purest, we call it the Platonian, you know, form of it, you know, is the more purest and abstract, you know, form before you get to the, we call it the shadows. And, you know, that are inevitable when you try to apply it, you know, and therefore you have to sully it a little bit or compromise it, you know, in the real world. And therefore the use of, you know, extreme categories, you know, to highlight certain things, just like, you know, just like a Tosis Rid, you know, can highlight, you know, or a, you know, or a Bala Itur, you know, and then, you know, from there you understand the concept, you know, crystal clear. And then, you know, it can be perhaps reformulated and maybe even in a more authentic and accurate way, you know, in a more moderate way or in a way which, you know, takes into account other, you know, legitimate aspirations. I don't mean that still allows it to be acceptable or authentic despite the dilution. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is sometimes there's a benefit or an advantage to identifying, you know, the... So, again, I'm not speaking for the Rav, but... my understanding of some of the Rav's more extreme cases and writing, you know, is, you know, which I don't think he fully translated into his own, you know, life and even in his own work. But I think the reason for that is, you know, in addition to the effective style and so on, is because I think, you know, you have these extremes and then you understand that, you know, sometimes a better way to actually implement them, not to compromise them, right, is to be fully committed to these ideas and then to understand that, you know, that sometimes, you know, they express themselves, you know, even in more subtle ways. And I think that, you know, again, whether there are numerous, you know, very extreme stories in Ish Halacha, which have been, you know, spoken about a lot, I think they're all just incredible stories. They're all very inspiring, if you ask me. But whether you would do them or whether the Rav would do them, I think is highly, you know, debatable. But if he wouldn't, it's not because, you know, he's not living up to the ideal or we wouldn't be living up to the ideal. It's because that ideal is really highlighted. And often, you know, there are other internal halachic factors, you know, that require that, let's say, to use the Rav's own terminology, you know, if the mechayev is reflected by the extreme paradigm, you know, sometimes the kiyum mitzvah, you know, requires, you know, more subtlety or is more complex. And again, I've said this many times in the past about Kedushas HaZman and Kedushas HaMakom, right? We have, you know, institutions in halacha that represent extremes. Yom Kippur is an extreme. And, you know, Purim is an extreme. You know, and so on. And nobody thinks that every day of the year, ideally even, should be Yom Kippur, or every day of the year. I shouldn't say nobody thinks. Mostly we do not think that every day of the year should be Purim or Yom Kippur, or even Chag HaMatzos, or even Chag HaShavuos. The idea of Kedushas HaZman is that you have an outlet, you know, to affirm, this is me speaking now, not saying this in the name of the Rav, although I think he would have believed it, you have an outlet to affirm, you know, these principles, and then, mostly, you know, the complex and multifaceted goal, you know, of Torah requires, you know, that we relate to a lot of things at the same time. So, you know, whether you want to, you know, say it as simply as, you know, kula lachem, kula lachem, you know, these are examples of it. And, you know, visiting the Mikdash, you know, is, and Yerushalayim, and Aliyah L'Regel, you know, are important, you know, facets of being a halachic Oved Hashem. And, you know, that doesn't mean that your whole life is defined by, there's Aliyah L'Regel. And if you, you know, there's no lechatchila to do Aliyah L'Regel every single day. You know, it's not just that, you know, that's the minimum. And I think that this is true of some of these, you know, notions as well. That this, you know, this notion of what I'm calling an extreme hafochba de kulaba or keneged kulam, this idea, you know, of Torah being adequate, self-sufficient, you know, the linchpin of many institutions, the primary vehicle for, you know, the impossible, you know, bond, you know, of achdut ha-maskil v'ha-muskal, and everything that we discussed the first semester, which is really based on that, about Birchas HaTorah, whether it's the Ramban version, the Rambam version, the, you know, the Lavush version, you know, all the different versions which are overlapping. I think all of that is true and magnificently, you know, captured. And at the same time, you know, there are other mikzos HaTorah. Clearly, you know, I wouldn't try to dissuade somebody from saying Tehillim on Yom Kippur. Again, or, you know, even, you know, being involved in, you know, singing, a little bit of singing in the Beis HaKnesses. Because I think there are makoros that clearly establish that this too. But that doesn't mean it competes with or is a substitute for Talmud Torah. It just means that there has to be a broader, and I would say the same thing about, you know, some of the, I think Klal Yisrael paskind, and I think the Rav agrees with this and kind of alludes to it as well, you know, that there are many benefits of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's movement. And it's important to identify the opposition to it. Are we taking somebody's, is somebody supposed to be in here? So just make sure. We'll move to the end. I want to finish the and say one more thing, but we could. I just don't want to keep somebody out who's supposed to be here. What? Okay, so let's move. Can we move to our room now? Yeah. Suggesting was that again the idea of the idea that is expressed still, this is still the end of the whatever, right? The ideas that are expressed here about the self-sufficiency and even again some the offense taken at the implication, let's say, of the need to supplement and to complement as a function, let's say, of inadequacy. Is, I think, a very powerful and very compelling point. And that still doesn't mean that there aren't, in the Mishnah that we have and in the larger, you know, concept of Avodas Hashem, other things, just as I think, you know, one can be committed, and I certainly feel this way, to the world of Brisk and still appreciate that there are other strands and strata of thought. I don't think it means unlimited, but, you know, that share much with that and that, you know, enrich even that level of commitment. So I say that not out of concession and compromise and dilution, but I think as a strength. And I think in my own experience as a Talmud of two really great Rebbeim, the Rav Zatzal and Rav Lichtenstein Zatzal, that's one of the things, I don't know if they articulated it so much, but certainly they lived it and articulated it by, you know, by how they lived and even by the positions that they took. Again, you know, you could read Ish Halacha, this is part of a larger conversation, or other things that the Rav wrote and get, you know, an impression. Well, you can't really get an impression of narrowness because, you know, just the language and the ability to articulate these things, you know, and to draw upon the kind of sources and ideas. The sophistication, you know, is something which demonstrates, you know, breadth of knowledge and especially breadth of a vision, you know, which could only be a result, you know, of you know, really having, you know, been immersed, you know, in all sorts of different things and figuring out, you know, what to take, what to filter, you know, and how to use it, and so on. So whether it's, you know, the posture, you know, just the body language, the articulation, the writings themselves, it's clear that, you know, notwithstanding some of these more extreme formulations, which are, again, I think, you know, very powerful, and I like them. I'm not offended by them at all. I think, you know, that they, you know, I gave the mashal of Kedushas HaZman and Kedushas HaMakom. The idea that, you know, we do have respect for, you know, whether it's the, you know, positive aspects of Musar, or even, you know, Chasidus, or other, you know, ways or modes of Avodas Hashem, that there's a hierarchy. I think that that is something which is not only acceptable, but really which is a greater lechatchila. Having said that, it doesn't mean that everything is equal. That certainly is antithetical to many of these formulations. The idea that the foundation stone, the linchpin, really is the learning and the you know, the norm. You know, if we have a full commitment to those, you know, principles, then, you know, one can see as a greater ambition, even, you know, finding a proper way, you know, to enrich that, you know, with, you know, with other things that historically Chachmei Yisrael embraced and Klal Yisrael embraced, and surely that in itself is very significant. But, you know, we really have to, like in anything, know what that hierarchy is and what the foundations are, and proceed from there. Ish Halacha and his stance, I say, and the Rav was very knowledgeable about Musar movement, and it wasn't, believe me, it wasn't Dam Al Hashiv, and he understood Chasidus, and he understood all of these things out of, not just because he was someone who had a capacious, you know, curiosity, but it was out of his respect for, again, the total, you know, legacy in Masorah of Klal Yisrael, and the great people who, you know, who promulgated some of these principles and ideas, and because he knew that, you know, as you know, the grandson of his grandfather and the son of his father, and so on and so forth, he knew that, you know, he had the proper balance, and could do the proper filtering as well. So it's very interesting to compare. I'm just going to say a word about this, and then we have to get back to the real things, right? The Chazon Ish, in his you know, Emunah Bitachon, as I also takes interesting stands, and in other things, in certain igros that he wrote on the Musar movement. First of all, it's just interesting to note, if people are not familiar with it, that the writing style of Emunah Bitachon is just, again, incredibly impressive. It's a difficult sefer to read because the Hebrew is very sophisticated, and you know, it's not a Hebrew that you would expect necessarily, if you don't understand the fullness, again, of the Chazon Ish, who he was. And he was somebody who was, you know, in many respects, you know, self-taught. Again, he we'll talk maybe a little bit about his background, but a lot of his very independent and very creative, but in a very different way than the world of Brisk, almost in an opposite way, much more, I guess, Bishita responsive, let's say, you know, to you know, any particular issue or sugya, rather than having, you know, coming armed with, let's say, a methodology or you know, perspective in, you know, what the categories are likely to be. I don't just mean a priori, but, you know, a vocabulary or any of that, which is fascinating. But the Hebrew is just, you know, really reflects like a deep person who, you know, is really not struggling, but who just, you know, has the capacity, like, to express in almost poetic language, you know, his yearning for the Ribbono Shel Olam, and again his passion about the centrality of Talmud Torah. Again, in an equally powerful way, notwithstanding a lot of overlap and notwithstanding, you know, some differences. So what's fascinating is that the Perek Aleph of Emunah Bitachon is, again, very poetic, and it's all about the Bria and the nature of man. Again, maybe we'll talk some about it, because I think there's some interesting assumptions there. Perek Beis is his view on Emunah and Bitachon, what Bitachon really means. And he eschews until the very end, where he kind of, applies mostly what he had rejected, but and not as a stira, but eschews the idea that bitachon means, you know, your belief, you know, that it'll all turn out good. Is his view on bitachon is based on emuna, that there is hashgacha in the world, and that, you know, events unfold as they're supposed to, according to the Rabbanu Shalom's plan. Which is not the same as assuming, you know, that you'll get what you want. Have bitachon, you know, that it'll all be good for you. Have bitachon that there's a plan in the world, that there's hashgacha, and so on. Again, comments on Yosef and Hishtadlus in the end are a little bit more challenging to understand. But the third chapter is where he begins to speak about the concept of Musar. And it's pretty clear that the first and the second, you know, in part are just, you know, the Hagdama, you know, to this issue, which he struggled with or weighed in on, certainly. I had a lot to say, apparently, throughout his whole life. And again, there's a history there, too, in terms of what he was exposed to and some vikuchim that he had. And he begins his discussion of Musar with a very strong statement about the interchangeability of halacha and musar, in the sense that what he's trying to preclude clearly is the assumption of the musar movement, again, about the inadequacy of Torah alone, or the idea that there can ever be a conflict between halacha and musar, that there can be a situation, you know, where the halacha is machriya in a certain way, you know, but it's not the proper thing to do. Of course, he has to contend at some point with the question of lifnim mishuras hadin, and, you know, kofin al midas, you know, stone. But we do have contexts in which, you know, hanging on to, like, the letter of the law, let's say, when one is in violation of either some broader spirit of law or the spirit of a particular law, you know, is a problem. So that's something that I have to trace a little bit, see how the Chazon Ish contends with that. But his first words, and again, I want to move on, so we'll pick up at this next week, but just as a little 2 points very quickly, his first words are really just to establish unequivocally, and if you understand, again, you know, the broader strokes of this whole discussion, you can appreciate it. Otherwise, you can just miss it. Chovot, chovot hamusariot heima lefamim guf echad im piskei ha'alacha. Halacha hi amachras es ha'osar ves ha'mutar shel Torah ha'musar. That's a very seemingly innocuous statement, but a very powerful statement. Meaning, there's no such thing as something being halachically correct, you know, it's in keeping with the halachic achra, and being immoral or unethical. Keitzad, and the example that he uses is very fascinating. Amru b'avasar chafala fomad beis dimalam de tinokos ein taina shall pasakt lechiyusi. The question of, you know, essentially competition, right? And when, you know, you have a certain, entrenched group, right? And what about unfair or new, you know, competition, you know, from the outside? So the Gemara Bava Basra says, again, you have to look at the whole piece, and it's just written very beautifully. Harish Eish Beir Malam de Misparnusin Me Amalam, Ulifiton Bo Malam de Macher Me Iracheret, right? Ubeteva Bne Adam Enam Sveim Ratzon Me Hayishanot. That's a little bit of a dig. Everybody wants something new, so, like, you know, it's nothing to do with the quality, doesn't always have to do with the quality of the, of the status quo, but people are always looking for, you know, for the newest and the latest. So kofzu kulam ala orchim hachadashim umlam de ha'ir nizoku. So you have this, you know, competition, you know, struggle. Hamakupachim pashtu sinatam belibam ala rodfim hachadashim, right, the ones who are, you know, the entrenched, you know, status quo, you know, educational system, you know, feel that they are, you know, being undermined. Umisina saleb yatu lebake shalem toanot mumbim balilos velamdu lishonam dabera lehem umera el ra yat. This is the beautiful poetic language. Yatzau lahotzi dibas shav ulorer rachme bnei ha'ir neged hakzarius shalabayim achadashim. Again, very dramatic and powerful language. Acho sifu biktatos umerivos elitim nokmimem nekamos ashetimate yadam. Hine kol maaseim hayu minukim bikolchet. If the halacha had been that this was unfair competition and that it protected the status quo, then even the ethical complaints, you know, would have been, not even, the ethical complaints would have been a natural corollary. Limros, rather, neged halacha, shenem l'moshe rabbeinu alav shalom b'sinai. This is a very strong isha lacha type statement. This is just a great, again, in very dramatic style, how the halacha is koveya, not just what can and can't be done in the community, right, and, you know, live with it, but, you know, even the, you can use inflammatory terms for either side, that's determined by the halacha itself. And then he adds, Michovos hamusarios, I think that's an important line, or important phrase, right? It's obligatory from an ethical point of view. Sheishtadal ha'adam latat bilavavo et ha'ikar hagadal hazeh. Shebechol mekrei asher nifkashim re'ehu tzarich lishkol b'pele sahalacha ladas mihu arodef umihu hanirdaf. Umar no ra'am, skipping, hi ha'mach shela v'rabat ha'puka liot min ha'machlifim es arodef l'nirdaf es ha'nirdaf l'rodef. Basher ledat amitato ein makom zulat b'sifrei ha'poskim asher misarum lanu mitzukei tevel rabosenu zal. Meaning, it's an ethical obligation, right, for one to know that the halacha defines, you know, the appropriate ethical. Again, you have to somehow account here for, you know, things like midas tom and lifnei mishuras hadin, you know, and kedoshim tiyu. You know, obviously he'll tell you that those are all, you know, internal factors, you know, in particular applications. Umishalo hukba belibo hayisodaze, lo yo ilenu rav likacho, the omet shkedato liknos midos mitukanos. As much as work as you do, you know, in tikkun amidos of Musar, if somehow this point escapes you, namely that the halacha drives not just the result, the norm, despite the Musar, but that the halacha is the source of Musar, then it's been wasting your time. The af im, right, hinan mitukanot, lo yatimu le'itim krovot im halacha shemaimis, v'misod mishpato, yemuvat kol toldotav titchayevna liot yalde zarim v'chever mashchisin. Again, very strong languages. Have a hoy, ki yizak mikre dardiki, debimata lefanav isbar chatzilenu mirodfai kiam tsumimeni umin hashamayim baskal taneu hoy al osim maisa zimri umabakshim skarb kapinchas halo atahu arodev halo atahu she'en chanose panim la Torah halo kasafti b'torosai the mikri dardiki lamatzi la'akev. So again, this isn't despite or overriding ethics. To him, this is like an ethical principle. And then he notes that this is very difficult for people to comprehend. Yitzro shel adam mitgaber alav biyoter bizman she'en achet megula v'tzorech diyun. Like people, you know, are particularly vulnerable when the halacha is more complicated and there are you know, discussions or machloksim about it. That's in particular where the people think that their own ethical, let's say, intuition, you know, should ki ein la haregesh mavchin b'halacha l'chein lo nifleisi ki min ha'yichidim ha'metukonim b'midoseim b'mida yidua nifgashnu b'mida acheres b'mikra miyuchad. Meaning people even who are, you know, well trained in the world of Musar, you know, can really undermine, you know, ethical norms. Kinyanei mida haromema shel ha'achna l'mishpat shnayim heim, and he goes on to explain how this works. And I'll leave you with just one last line. He then quotes Rabbi Yisrael Salanter itself, which is a powerful thing to do, considering that he's talking about abuses in the Musar movement. But obviously, he understood that Yisrael Salanter himself was a critical, you know, linchpin in Masorah. And then finally, ubnei adam hashlizyon aleph in Gimel, bnei adam hashleimim b'tov amidos b'yosam mislam demaleim b'narusam b'sifrei tikun amidos, that hilchos hamishpat lo lamdu, meaning somebody who, you know, is a gaon seemingly in Musar but not in halacha. The libam lo kana et abat hamishpat svuyim hema lecholi shel ivus hadin yoser me'elu hadyotos hadyotim sorry shel lo lomdu es hamusar hayira v'toras amidos. He said better. This is a strong statement, and we'll talk more about it. Better an am haaretz, right, who knows nothing of Musar, than somebody who is steeped in Musar, you know, but inadequate in Torah, and who therefore feels, you know, that you know what he's doing is preferred or is itself an expression of Torah. And he says this both ideologically and pragmatically. So you can see already again the roots of. But what I want to explore is what do you do about these exceptions? And also, he himself, despite an earlier stage of his life being, you know, very very critical, kind of came round, after many decades, maybe based on his own experiences or the moderation of, you know, the application of the Musar movement, to appreciate some of its elements and kind of to modify just a little bit. But this halachocentrism, as well as we'll read some passages, Chazon Ish is hugely assertive about, again, the dignity of man, and his hugely optimistic about man's nature. So again, he too has a double, let's say, critique of the Musar movement. One is the critique of the Mardik, and the other this question of the, you know, the role of Torah. He never goes as far as Brisk, you know, in denouncing that part of Musar. But the idea that there is a fissure, or that there is a gap, you know, between Musar and Halacha, is something which he too found to be ideologically and practically, especially ideologically, intolerable. So we'll continue with this and some of the nuances of his position going forward. Okay.